Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I am joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone.
And Randy Olson.
Happy to be back. Hello.
So we are back after a week. Our last show was on August 27th. And we drew attention to a number of anniversaries on that day of peace history, if you will. And at the end of the show, we did a couple of things. One is we drew attention to the day following August 27th, which was August 28th, which is now behind us, today being September 3rd. But August 28th, we noted, is not only the opening of the Peace Palace in 1913, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in 1963. But also this day is an important day for African American history. We played a clip of Ava DuVernay, who made the movie Selma and who made the intro film to the Smithsonian National African American History Museum in Washington, D.C. And we also ended that show by referencing the Golden Rule. And we noted that the International Council of Women, which was organized in 1888 on the 40th anniversary of Seneca Falls, which began the U.S. women's rights movement, enshrined in their constitution the application of the Golden Rule to custom, law, and society. That brings us to today's show, which is really going back to this. We're sort of inspired by the date of August 28th in organizing this show because we did mention last week that this August 28th is the first August 28th that we pass through without former U.S. Congressman John Lewis, who died this year on July 17th. So that's sort of our guiding star, but our objective for this show is to lay a foundation for a dialogue that I think will take a couple of shows where we try to get clear on the relationship amongst the Golden Rule, justice, and the peace through law movement. And we include the civil rights movement or the nonviolent wing of the civil rights movement within the peace through law movement. So I think that today's show will be somewhat conceptual and theoretical. We'll see how the conversation goes. But let me draw attention to the title and sort of situate us there, and then we'll begin the dialogue. The title is From the Golden Rule to the Freedom Rides, Reflecting on Peace and Justice. And the Golden Rule in this context is used not only to refer to the moral principle of the Golden Rule, but also of this sailboat that was used to draw attention to the nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands. This is a long story, and we probably should devote shows to this story of the voyage of the Golden Rule. This happened in the 50s, and the captain of the sailboat was named Albert Bigelow. And there's a link on our show resources page to his book, The Voyage of the Golden Rule, An Experiment with Truth. And that subtitle is a direct reference to to Gandhi's autobiography, My Experiments with Truth. why is that linked to the Freedom Rides? The Freedom Rides were important nonviolent agitations during the civil rights movement And John Lewis was a participant in the Freedom Rides. So before the March on Washington, you had the Freedom Rides. And on one of the Freedom Rides, Al Bigelow sat next to John Lewis. They sat together. They participated in an action. We may get to that today. This is covered in John Lewis's first book called Walking with the Wind, if you're interested in more of that history. So the title, From the Golden Rule to the Freedom Rides, is, you know, at least in my mind, these things are all connected. Albert Bigelow's sailing into the Marshall Islands to draw attention to the nuclear testing there, which we have discussed on earlier shows, was the effects of those testing had made the Marshall Islands file a complaint in the International Court of Justice in 2015, I think it was. We have a show on that. But that is connected to, of course, the peace through law movement as much as the civil rights movement. So that's a sort of a little bit about the title. And when I learned that Albert Bigelow was sitting next to John Lewis, I just was just sort of struck by that image. And last week we talked about visuals, the importance of visual symbols for the peace through law movement, and that is just such an important visual. I tried to find a picture of them together. I can't find one, but in your mind's eye, if you can imagine, you know, these two men. Albert Bigelow was, you know, a rather tall white man sitting next to John Lewis on a bus where they basically know they're going to be beat up, and hopefully we talk about that later. But that's also an image to think of, right? And thinking of that image, really, I think, Taylor, you said last week that these sort of visuals, one of the roles that they play is they help us to enter the forest. And this visual also helps us to, like, see these connecting threads between war, nuclear weapons, racism, and Martin Luther King brought out those connections in his anti-Vietnam War speech that we – I don't think we've talked about that yet, but we should at some point. But before we sort of move to – the outline that we're all working with, I just want to open it up to see if anybody wants to add anything to this sort of setting the context for our dialogue today.
Yeah, I'd like to chime in briefly. One of the things that I have a tendency to do is to state the obvious. And what I'd like to do is try to create a frame which is both general and useful, trying to put these enormous ideas in some kind of single frame. So when we talk about peace, I talked about it a lot more on our first show on May 18th, but basically the definition that I, and hopefully we all will be operating from today, comes from Jane Addams, which she defines peace as the unfoldment or unfolding of worldwide processes that make for the nurture of human life. And that's very different than just not a state of war. And there's more to that, but suffice to say that is a general definition of peace. And what a lot of these social movements and a lot of these individual activities that people as individuals are participating in with the end goal of a peaceful state, what they're doing is they're acting out a principle and they're bringing something specific into the world. And that, it turns out, at the level of the individual, is exactly the same thing that has to happen at the highest levels of abstraction in order for a state of peace to emerge on the planet, or in a country, or in a specific neighborhood even, right? The individuals have to act in a way that the entire, you know, community acts, which creates this structure. And I like to think of it as like a scaffolding, right? There's like a, you need a bottom. And then once you have that, which is the individuals, you can have a set of principles that all the individuals seem to be operating from collectively. And when we start talking about these sort of high levels of abstraction, when we're talking about like national laws, we're dealing with an enormous aggregate of individuals. But those individuals, you know, can be collectively referred to as a single entity. And that's what, you know, the concept of a nation is supposed to be built on. And so, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about the golden rule, which is, you know, in the positive frame, like treat others in a way that you would want to be treated. And when a nation is treating another entity in a specific way, the golden rule proves to be a useful framework through which we can evaluate that nation's actions, right? It's like, if this were a single person doing this to another single person, would it look like something that we would be comfortable like watching other humans do on an individual scale? So yeah, that's like big general, but hopefully as simple as necessary frame for peace and morals and where I think we're going.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Anybody else want to contribute to the laying of the foundation or the context here? The frame, as Randy refers to it.
I really enjoy Randy's idea of, and that's a really hard thing to do. I know as I've come to grapple with all these really big ideas that, you know, applying the golden rule at a national level and sort of viewing the interactions of nations and international entities within that framework can be very hard for someone to conceptualize, because you think, oh, it's so much more complex. It's this big thing about power and stuff. But I agree with Randy. When you really look at it through that golden rule lens, you can sort of see how that principle works in fostering peace, and that all of that sort of intertangled vintage that surrounds the idea of what international relations is, like the like power and interactions through that sense, that it really does work. And I think that's something that I know I have to continually remind myself of, because I, throughout the majority of my life, have always operated from the stance that, oh, well, that golden rule in international settings, that's just, like, absurd. It's all this, like, power and interactions in that sense. So I know that's something I personally, you know, continuously remind myself of.
Hmm. And I also just want to remind all, I mean, I've said it, but just, you know, this was in the Constitution of the International Council of Women. You can look it up, 1888, and you can see the language. And so as early as that, you know, there's a recognition that this needs to be applied at, you know, a larger scale than the individual. Of course, both are important, but the International Council of Women is operate like they're looking at domestic relations and international relations in that way. And their very first public act as an international organization is undertaken in 1899. And they proclaim, and Bertha von Suttner actually, who's supposed to be there in London, but she's in The Hague at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, they allow her to submit this motion remotely, if you will. She's not physically present. And she proposes to have the International Council do everything in its power to support the goals of the arbitration movement. And I think that is a visual, and of course, you know, it's seconded and it's adopted as an official platform. And so that's another sort of image, if you will, or concrete thing that helps us to link these disparate, seemingly disparate moments or movements that in fact are very much connected in a thread. And Taylor, anything on this bit before we?
Yeah, I was going to say with, you know, Randy's point, you know, and previously he mentioned the idea of having this pin and taking it off when you violate the golden rule. And, you know, his idea of, you know, putting on to countries the same golden rule that we put on to people. And I think this kind of goes into, like, international law. And a lot of people say, oh, international law, we don't have a police, international police force, it's not really enforceable. But in a way, international law and the commitments people make are not people, but I guess, yes, people, of the people running these countries make, are kind of like putting on a pin. And when you breach it, you get called out, and it's like taking off that pin. So when, you know, they're making human rights treaties and they're agreeing to these various commitments, sure, there's not an international police force, but if, you know, the Human Rights Commission or another, an NGO calls you out for breaching your commitments, you have to face that. And I think that's kind of the same principle when we talk about justice and peace and the golden rule. I think there's like that, also that international law and like cooperation and commitment element to it.
So this like accountability piece, the pin helps to keep you accountable to a principle, and these international laws and pledges, when we violate them, other groups and so forth help to remind us of our commitments and hold us accountable. So accountability is, I think, an important part of all of this. And that also, I think, connects to the civil rights movement and just like bringing to consciousness the fact that there are these laws, Supreme Court rulings in particular, and this is what happens when you try to, quote, enforce them, brutality and so forth. And so many, as I understand it, you know, people who witnessed the nonviolent protesters being assaulted joined because they recognized that this is really wrong. Okay, we're marking the importance of accountability, and that's really cool. So let's just bracket that. And that brings us to a clip that I would like to share of Lema Bowie. And if you don't know who she is, do Google her. You spell her last name G-B-O-W-E-E. And in 2013, we were in The Hague celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Peace Palace. And to mark that occasion, I'll just repeat it because perhaps you're coming to this podcast for the first time and you don't know the background, but to commemorate that moment, the first ever statue of a real woman was placed in the Peace Palace, and that was Bertha von Suttner. And that's so fascinating because last week, the first ever statue of real women was placed in Central Park on August 26th to mark the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted women a political voice. So there's this thing of like, remembering and concretizing these individuals, and this happens 100 years later. And Lema was the one who unveiled Bertha von Suttner in the Peace Palace. And if you Google it, you should be able to find some video footage of that. And the evening before that happened, she gave a speech in Delft, and you can watch this speech on the show resources page, I think from last week, and I'll put it on this week's show resources as well, just to be safe. And this is a clip from that speech. And throughout that speech, and I don't think she says it in this clip, but she keeps referring to peace as a, quote, labor of love. And I think that is really, really important, and that's also like that idea of peace work is a work of love. is absolutely 100% taken up by Martin Luther King, John Lewis, and others in the nonviolent wing of the civil rights movement. So this is the clip. It's about 5 minutes long, and we will come back and continue this discussion. This clip will help ground more discussion about the relationship amongst the Golden Rule, peace, justice, and accountability.
But the part of this story is of an old lady who passed 2 years ago. And she always used to talk fondly about her niece. And she would say her niece was her hand and foot. In our native language, if someone says, this person is my hand and foot, it meant that child was the one you could send and they would do anything for you. They ran your errands without any problems. And she told the story in one of our circles of how this girl went to get her water during the war. And the next thing they came and said, a boy killed her. She never saw the boy. No one explained anything, but she said she was grateful to God that she was able to bury her niece's corpse. So her niece had a grave, and that was her source of consolation. So we sent them into the camps to work with the boys, speak their language, do whatever they could do to calm them down. And she was in charge of feeding. So she went into where they were preparing the food, and we had some group of women who were in charge of different things, but they were there with the fighters. And she distributed food, and one of the fighters said, there's this boy in this room who is sick. He can't come out. So she went in the room, and he said, I'm hungry. She said, okay, I will feed you. So she washed her hands and started feeding him. And then he asked for her niece. And she said she'll call this girl her daughter, actually her niece. She died. He says, I know. She said, how did you know? He said, because I killed her. So the question was, did you stop feeding him? And she said, no. Why would I? Isn't that what peace is all about? I continue to feed him, knowing that I will come back to my community of peacemakers to cry. So she came into the office and fell on the floor that evening and cried her heart out. Are you angry? No. Do you want God to punish him? No. If there was this thing of taking him to court, will you want him to go to court? No. Why? Because if taking him to court would mean we would never have peace, I will forget about my pain and let us have peace. And this has been the story, one after the other, with women that I've worked with. And some over the last few days, I've been thinking when Bertha von Suttner and others were doing the work that they did they ever imagine wars, like Ambassador Rapp was saying, to be fought on the bodies of women? Did they ever imagine that a woman would be raped 20 times over a period of 3 years in places like the DR Congo? When they were talking about arbitration and justice and all of the different things. When those who visioned the peace palace, did they imagine that we would have a war, a world where women being a woman would be more frightening as, what's his name say, than being a soldier? Did they ever imagine we'll come to this place where people would be prepared to sacrifice their life, the quest for justice, to live in a semblance of peace? My experience with women organizing have been, yes, we build movements. Yes, we work for peace 24/7. And in most instances, and I'm sure you can relate to that, Ingrid, without pay, but with a passion that no one can understand, the end result, if this case going to court or going to the ICC would mean an eruption of violence, then I would rather forget justice and just give me peace. So when you look at those who did the flag and Bertha and all of these people, their work was surely a labor of love. But in my mind, I keep asking myself, the way we do peace now, is it truly a labor of love?
So that was Lama Bowie on August 27th, 2013, addressing an international group of people on the eve of the 100th anniversary of the Peace Palace before she unveiled the statue of Bertha von Suttner. And I'll just open it up for people to react to this clip, but because I have, you know, some things to say, but I would rather, if someone else wants to begin, please feel free to react.
Well, if the floor is open, I always
apparently it is.
Always like to step in. Yeah. So the first thing is that we're dealing with an extremely complicated example, right? Where if we tried to look at that, the woman who was feeding the child, who she found out was, you know, responsible for the death of her hand and foot. There's this enormous question about values, and the question is like, well, what is the most important thing? And Lama Bowie seems to be indicating that, you know, like the tranquil state that has been achieved based on a number of circumstances is more important than the like retributive justice that she might, you know, potentially get to feel by like prosecuting or, you know, hauling in this individual to a court or anything approaching what we normally think about as justice. But, you know, on a deeper level, one of the things that I really sunk in for me was how crime actually gets punished. And it came from the book Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, where, you know, the main character, Raskolnikov, gets away with a murder. But the real punishment is a psychological one, where, like, the person before the murder is not the same person as the one after, and it just cripples a person when they, you know, take justice in their own hands, basically, and try to rewrite the laws based on their own rationale. And so, you know, the woman in the example and Lama Bowie are making a strong case in a way that's, you know, sufficiently easy to understand, that it would not actually improve the situation. The boy knows that what he did was wrong. He's sitting there suffering. It's clear as day. That's why he's not able to feed himself, and he's sitting there in the room by himself, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all implied. It's not part of the story and part of the narrative that she unpacked, but it's implied. And the point is, okay, we don't need to add suffering to suffering. Let's try to make the world a better place, even if there's a personal load of pain that has to go along with that. That's the price of peace.
Maybe I have a slightly different take on it. So I found her speech incredibly inspiring and interesting, and I remember sitting there and watching it several times with Hope. But I guess one thing that I've thought of since is, you know, in that situation, the woman had gone through the work internally. And I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's important to recognize that some people haven't gone through the work, maybe because they were, like, traumatized. I mean, PTSD is a very real thing. And I just wonder if we should put the onus on victims to bring about peace. And I think, like, justice, like, especially in international criminal justice, kind of takes the onus off of victims to, like, not that they aren't doing that inner work, but it makes it easier for them maybe to forgive because someone else. And obviously, in an ideal world, we can forgive everyone. But I think it's, like, very important to recognize that, like, in that situation, you have someone who's, like, come to terms with, you know, how to forgive and whatnot, and just not everyone who's been through a war or been through a moment like has that sort of inner power. And I don't know if that would actually contribute further to war if they want to start seeking vengeance, because if you come from it from a point of view where you haven't forgiven that person, it's natural for someone to try to seek vengeance. And I think, like, justice is meant to help procure peace in those situations where, like, that person's not going to forgive, or, like, there are groups of people who are not going to forgive maybe, like, a war criminal. And, like, this is really a way to prevent further conflict and escalation of conflict.
I remember being very just in awe of Lamba Bowie's speech. The entire speech is absolutely incredible. And I appreciate, because after Hope had sent it out for all of us to watch and, you know, sort of collect our thoughts on it, I sent her a really long email of many different points and contradictions. It was a big moment of cognitive dissonance for me. And I really appreciate your point, Taylor, of sort of, you know, helping to frame in the sense that it was really hard for me to, you know, think of the individual who had suffered so much and endured so much, then having to continue to live and internalize that while, you know, the perpetrators of their hurt continue to exist within their community. There was one really powerful story from the speech where a mother-daughter had fled to a town or a city on the other side of the country during the Civil War. And 2 years later, after the war had ended, she found out that her daughter had married the man who had killed her son during the war. And it was this whole conflict of, do I tell my daughter that the man she is married and happily in love with was the one who murdered my son in the war? And it was just this incredibly complex and thought-provoking situation where it really made me start to grapple with what does constitute peace, what does constitute justice. I think in one sense, Lamba Bowie's correct in that peace and love and having to deal with your own hurt and the peace process is very individualistic in that sense. But I also agree with you, Taylor, that there needs to be some higher entity mediating the peace process, and that the individuals who had suffered that hurt, like you said, might have not been to the point where internally they would be able to just live and accept that. And then they themselves would then go out and try to seek retribution or sort of to right the wrong that they feel has been committed against them. So, but no, it was absolutely incredible. And it is still something that I continue to think, reflect, and ponder on, because it was truly something that was a paramount moment for me personally in coming to understand the peace process.
And she doesn't mention the golden rule in her speech. The way that she puts it is that these women didn't want to rock the boat, that it was more important for them to have peace, that that's like the more important value. And I just want to raise the question of what you all thought about, like, is this a context in which the golden rule is implicitly being used? She doesn't mention it, but do you think that's going on psychologically in these women, or is it this other kind of calculus going on? And they're not so much thinking about the perpetrators as what, how would I want to be treated if I was a perpetrator, but they're thinking more of their community and the sort of stability thereof.
I think it can be both, right? So the character in the story, the main woman who was, you know, feeding the essentially the perpetrator, it's like in that moment she's clearly doing multiple things at one time, right? One of which is recognizing the suffering of a human being. And that isn't a unidimensional suffering, right? There's a hunger and there's a suffering from psychological distress about being the kind of person who kills other people and what the effect that has on a person. And at the same time, there's this recognition that her actions are part of a set of things that are in the community, that like what she does is going to ripple outwards. And if she tries to take any particular kind of vindictive or revenge based set of procedures, set of actions, it's going to have a consequence that may in fact rock the boat. And so it's like, it can be both, right? There. Mm-hmm. And one of the cool parts is that when we're acting compassionately, it's almost a given, and it's not always, right? But it's almost a given that it's going to be lining up all the layers that the peace process needs in order to bring itself into the world, right? Because it's like the compassionate action has built into it the acknowledging the divinity of the individual, and it has the, you know, taking the action that's most likely going to bring about a good situation in the long term for the community and a bunch of other things, right? It's something that's amazing about compassion, and that's why all the spiritual traditions on the planet that I'm aware of have compassion as like a tenet that it's like a safe rule of thumb to operate from.
Anybody else on this?
Oh, go ahead, Taylor.
Oh, no, go ahead, Max.
Oh, I would agree with Randy that I think it's twofold in that sense, that shoot others, if you were, you know, the perpetrator of violence and, you know, you had murdered someone and then you're sort of coming to understand, like, that is a pain and a suffering that if you're able to feel those things, that is something you'll have to contend with for the rest of your life. And so to not be further subjected to pain from an outside source, I think that's very golden rule-ish. But I also think that these women were very politically minded. And I know in political science, there's this concept called blowback, where, you know, a nation will commit something and then another nation will try to correct that wrong. But then that only further hardens the resilience of certain individuals on that first nation to then attack the one that is trying to seek retribution for something, and then the cycle just continually perpetuates. So I think they're very politically savvy in that sense of, if we, you know, can sort of internalize and deal with personally what has been wronged against us, that we can hopefully bring our whole country to a state of calm and perpetual peace.
I think also, like, when we talk about compassion and the golden rule and we talk about justice and peace and this tension, I think it's important to acknowledge that in the U.S., at least, we have this idea of accountability as punishment and retribution. And there is, like, a lot to be said about the idea of restorative justice and rehabilitation. And, you know, in different cultures, there are different ways that they go around about accountability and rehabilitation of perpetrators and bringing the community together and holding people accountable so that they understand what they did was wrong. But it's almost in a more compassionate way, because it's an opportunity for growth instead of destroying their lives, kind of. And it's very hard to understand that, I think, from like the American criminal justice point of view, because we have this idea, you put someone in jail and then you take away all their rights forever, and we don't really have that sort of idea of like, we're going to like try to restore this person. So if you look at it from a golden rule standpoint, there's not necessarily this tension with the golden rule of holding someone accountable, if you don't look at it from a point of view of retribution, but look at it from a point of view of like, how do we help this person restore sort of their humanity?
Yeah, and how do we, it goes back to something that Randy said earlier, that, you know, the perpetrator, like, he realized that what he did was wrong. And I think that this is, you know, one of the core pieces here of moving forward. So accountability is sort of becoming conscious that what I did was wrong. And one way to go about that is punishment. But, of course, it's not the only way. And there is this, as Randy was saying, like the person can come to actually see it and the consequences in his or her own life from the action. I do want to just sort of throw in another dimension to this discussion about, you know, how do we respond to wrongdoing and secure this accountability piece without punishment. And so going back to the title of the show, From the Golden Rule to the Freedom Rides, I said the sort of inspiration of that title is the fact that Albert Bigelow, who sailed the Golden Rule, sat next to John Lewis on a freedom ride in the Deep South in 1961. And there's a story that's told in John Lewis's book about how what they were trying to do was test whether bus terminals, which had white-only waiting rooms, were up to code with the recent Supreme Court ruling. It's a case called Virginia versus Boynton, and basically that ruling declared that white-only waiting rooms at bus terminals were unconstitutional. So the action here was to test whether or not the bus terminals in the Deep South were obeying the law, obeying the rule of the Supreme Court. And as John Lewis said, he says, I don't think any of these people had heard of Boynton. it's like they didn't get the memo, just like we've said before, the Emancipation Proclamation. They didn't get the memo in Galveston, Texas. So what happens is John Lewis tries to walk in to the white-only waiting room. And this is at a Greyhound terminal. And there's, you know, a bunch of young guys playing pinball outside. And they say, you can't go in here. And he said, I have a right to go in here on the grounds of the Supreme Court decision in the Boynton case. And they proceed to attack him and knock him to the ground. At that point, Al Bigelow puts his body in between John Lewis and his assailants, and they start hitting Al Bigelow, who never fights back, as he's, you know, a nonviolent activist. He's a Quaker. And they beat him until he goes unconscious. Okay. And then another freedom rider steps in, and finally, you know, it's broken up. But I'm reading now from the book. This is page 143. We said no to the offer to press charges. This was simply another aspect of the Gandhian perspective. Our struggle was not against one person or against a small group of people like those who attacked us that morning. The struggle was against a system, the system that had helped produce people like that. We didn't see these young guys who attacked us that day as the problem. We saw them as victims. The problem was much bigger, and to focus on these individuals would be nothing more than a distraction, a sideshow that would draw attention away from where it belonged, which was, in this case, the sanctioned system of segregation in the entire South. So it's a different take on this accountability piece, and they're saying, you know, to focus on the individual and punishing the individual through formal charges is actually undermining the whole effort and distracting from the struggle to dismantle this system. I just leave it open for anyone to comment on that if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I'll jump in. So one of the things that strikes me at this point is There's a quote that I'm going to butcher, but it's from Gandhi about if you solve a conflict with violence, what you're doing is planting the seeds for future violence. It's something like that, and the idea it spills into this conversation in a couple different places, and the one which Michael brought up earlier about this blowback idea, where if you step in and you do it in a way that's not particularly careful, you know, you're setting in motion like the seeds for other conflicts down the line. And in the same case here, where like the Freedom Rides were an entire nationwide effort, right? It was part of a large situation. It wasn't, it really wouldn't have helped anything to take these, you know, I don't know how many people were involved in the bus station that day, but like the Greyhound terminal folks they're not big enough fish, basically. And in order to, you know, really clean a system that's drenched in violence and blood, it's like you need a lot bigger fish. That's not a great analogy. I'm not painting it well, but like there's so much that has to be done in order to work against the tide of history, so to speak, where this violence as a strategy to resolve conflict has been going on forever until recently, right? That's been the only strategy until, you know, except for very select examples, which we hold up and venerate because they're exceptional and because they're tremendous. And they put this idea of the golden rule and they put this idea of nonviolence into our faces in a way that we can no longer deny, right? We see the truth in some sense of the Judeo-Christian ethic that holds up this idea that you can't return violence for violence. You can't return harm for harm. And if you do, it just pushes the domino, or it just pushes, you know, shifts the goalposts further away, and violence ends up becoming a problem for somebody else if you don't put your foot down and say, okay, I'm not going to tolerate this anymore. And so, I mean, we're dealing with a nice example where, like, taking individual justice into account may, in fact, impede peace in general, because peace is this higher order abstraction. It's a higher order ideal. It's a higher order process. And it's weird because you do have to choose between peace and justice all the time. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people want justice now, and they don't understand that the cost of justice now is peace now in way too many circumstances.
I mean, I just want to bracket the claim that peace is in conflict with justice all the time, and I think that deserves another 30 minutes to at least to dive into that. I think a specific conception of justice, like retributive or like justice qua punishment of the wrongdoer. But there are other conceptions of justice. Taylor mentioned, you know, restorative justice, and you mentioned Judeo-Christian, and you have this idea, never return harm for harm, even before Christ, if you will, and Socrates. But I also want to just throw in and I wish I had this clip to play it, but I didn't. Maybe next time I'll have it for our discussion. But John Lewis was the chairperson, I forget the formal title, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, S-N-C-C. And in the mid to late 60s, the sort of ideology of SNCC and of the civil rights movement, if you will, really changed. And the nonviolent, compassion, Judeo-Christian, Socratic thread, if you will, was seen as, you know, kowtowing to whites, and there was a kind of dispute within SNCC as to whether, as John Lewis puts it so eloquently, nonviolence is a way of life, and the golden rule is a way of life. And this is something that you don't just use as a political tactic, right? So the other, like the other wing was, no, you use nonviolence not as a way of life, but as a tactic. And in this interview where he's talking about this, they play a clip of Stokely Carmichael, who was, you know, famously started out as, you know, nonviolent as a way of life, and then transformed, you know, what, through impatience and disappointment after disappointment, and this happened. John Lewis never abandoned his principles, but Stokely Carmichael says something like, you know, when the revolution comes, it's going to be violent, and then we will have, you know, a humane community. And John Lewis says something like, he's just crazy, and what he's saying is nonsense, because the revolution that we're talking about is ultimately a revolution of thought. It is like this golden rule as the way of life. And that's really what we're fighting for. And I just wanted to throw that into to this discussion, because it connects all these different, you know, the macro and the micro. And we've used this phrase revolution of thought before, but there's just like, a change in thinking is what we're really fighting for, and that's the kind of systemic ill that needs to be rooted out. And the way that we root that out is through example and witness. So there's that. Anybody want to chime in and add to the complexity here?
I think everything you've just stated really speak, and what Randy was talking about as well, like the whole, you know, what John Lewis and the nonviolent wing of the civil rights movement was trying to achieve was a wider cultural change in the way we think, and that you have to move beyond this sort of political realm into one where it's very steeped in values, and you have to value people's humanity and want to put forth love and peace in the work into it to create a better society. And in that sense, peace is hard. That is not an easy concept to come about when you have people, another famous individual who was not on the nonviolent wing of the civil rights movement, Angela Davis, like her experience growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, was seeing Ku Klux Klan raids bomb churches. And so her worldview was very steeped in this militaristic activism of, you know, we will meet them sort of like with the fire that they are giving us. And that is sort of, I guess, would be considered an easier route because, you know, the tactics that they're throwing at you, why not throw back? Whereas John Lewis seems to be, no, we need to rise above all of this. And that's very profound.
Mm-hmm. And it is hard. And he was sort of questioning himself at the end of his life, like, have I done enough? And have I, because he did understand the importance of sharing this with young people. And that's really, really important. And sharing this history. And I think that's something that we could all, you know, continue to do is talk about these ideas as part of that effort. Taylor, anything on this?
Yeah, I guess one small point, as discussed or mentioned earlier, about seeing this as like a way of life and not just a political tactic, I think it's also important to recognize that it also works as a political tactic, which is one of the reasons people use it. So it's not coming from a place of weakness, because it takes incredible strength not to return violence, I think, for violence, especially when it comes to like loved ones or other people. But I think like it's not like a place of weakness, and it's not like from a place of like not being a strong person to not return violence to violence, because first of all, I think it shows a lot of conviction, but also like it has worked, and we see that in the civil rights movement. So it's not a bad idea. It's like, it's a way of life, but it also works. So.
Yes. And we're going to, I'm going to play a clip of John Lewis, actually. It's about 3 minutes long. And in this clip, he's taking calls. And this, I think this interview is from like 2003 or something like this. You can watch the whole thing on the show resources page. It's a C-SPAN interview on Washington Journal where various people are calling in. And one thing that struck me, if you should watch the whole thing, is that people are calling in, both Democrats and Republicans, and just praising him. So he's able to sort of, you know, be a unifying figure. But in this clip, you'll, I think I have the questioner, and you'll hear her saying, you know, things are worse, and he responds to it. This is about 3 minutes long. We'll briefly talk about it, and then we'll continue our discussion on peace versus justice and the Golden Rule.
Good morning. I'm calling from Fort Polk, Louisiana. Again, good morning, Republican John Lewis. I'm calling because I'm considered one of those vivacious baby boomers, early 30s, strong-willed black woman. And actually, I understand the march on Washington, but seem to be ridiculously frustrated. And I feel that although we have obtained our freedom, we still have a long way to go. The blacks, minorities, the women, men, we're still being grossly discriminated against, not only in our fair share of freedom in America, but overwhelmingly in employment and promotions, et cetera. Sir, the civil rights movement fared well in the late 60s, but I feel that the amendment or our Civil Rights Act does not protect the minorities nor the blacks in the year of 2000. I feel this because the racism and the discrimination is practiced more than today than in 1963.
Well, I'm not sure you said, and I appreciate you calling. I'm not sure I understood you. You didn't say Republican, John Lewis. I'm a Democrat. I represent Georgia, the city of Atlanta in the 5th District, and I've been in Congress 17 years, and I'm a pretty liberal, progressive Democrat by my record. But for those of you who think that nothing has changed, things have changed. In 1963, we still had those signs that said white men, colored women, white waiting, colored waiting. Segregation and racism was open, very overt. And if you don't believe anything has changed, come and walk in my shoes, and I'll show you we live in a different world. The scars and stains of racism may be still with us. We're not there yet. We have not yet created the beloved community, a truly interracial democracy. But we own our way, and we're not going back. We're not going to stand still. We're going to continue to make progress and build a beloved community, build a society that is at peace with itself. That is the direction of the American society. Where we see discrimination, where we see racism, where we see people being discriminated against because of their gender or sex or sexual orientation or whatever, we have to speak out against it. We all have to act. We all can make a contribution. We don't need to wait for another Martin Luther King Jr. to come along. We all have to be part of our own liberation.
40 years later, is that your message today at this march?
My message today will be that, really. That it's not enough for us just to look back. It is good to look back, to be renewed, to be inspired, to see what another generation did. But it's also important for people to say, well, they did it, we cannot do it. We all can do something. What is happening in America today, I think too many of us, not just young people, all of us, are too quiet.
So you can watch that whole interview on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. That was Congressman John Lewis talking about this idea of the beloved community. So this is sort of like goes back to the opening of the show where Randy quoted Jane Addams' definition of peace, the unfoldment of worldwide processes making for the nurture of human life. You could also, I think, substitute that for beloved community. So we're running out of time. We've been going for an hour, and I think in this conversation, what we've done is sort of lay out, you know, this definition of peace, talk about different conceptions of justice, and the golden rule, both at the individual level and scaled up at the community level. We've talked about different kinds of justice, retributive justice, justice and accountability as punishment versus some other way. To end, I would like to just spend a few minutes with this piece by Andrew Carnegie. I will put it on the show resources page. This is a very short bit where Andrew Carnegie in 1907 is addressing objections to the peace through law movement, which, as we have said, is like the peace through arbitration movement. And the second objection that he addresses in response to is, quote, justice is higher than peace. So there's this claim that justice is higher than peace. And this claim, actually, the lineage of it goes back to the National Peace and Arbitration Congress in New York. I know some of you on this show know about that. But Andrew Carnegie responds by saying basically that you can't, like, justice forbids a man being a judge in his own case when he's a party to the issue. He says, quote, all law rests upon this throughout the civilized world. Were a judge known to sit upon a case in which he was secretly interested, he would be dishonored and expelled from high office, unquote. And then later, if he resorts to force in defense of his right to judge, he is dishonored as a breaker of the law. Thus, peace with justice is secured through arbitration, either by court or by tribunal, and never by one of the parties sitting as a judge in his own cause. I mean, that just opens up another dimension of these concepts. And what I hear him sort of tacitly referring to here is this core piece of justice, which others have referred to as, quote, impartiality, that justice requires a sort of disinterested, impartial perspective. And if we're actually, you know, related to the case, or if one of the parties, we can't morally, legally be a judge in our own case. So just anybody on this, and we'll sort of, this will be the end of this show, but we'll continue it next week with the rest of the outline, which we didn't get through today. But any thoughts on justice and impartiality?
Well, I have a number of things to say. I'll limit it to an example, and I hope that the example illustrates itself. You know, this morning I was playing Uno with two children, and one of the children was cheating, and we caught him. And it was obvious, right? It was like it was him cheating, and then we determined that, in fact, it couldn't have been the case that things happened this way. And there was a couple different ways that we could deal with that, right? We could have, like, both me and the other child, we could have, like, attacked him, right? We could put him in jail, put him in timeout. You know, those things are all possibilities. But... And in fact, you know, one of the things that actually took place was that we didn't have to do any form of retribution, because being kind of, you know, friends that we all are, it was easy for this child to recognize after the fact, once the other people drew their awareness to that action, it was easy for that individual to recognize the wrong that they had committed. And it's interesting to me because it would not have been necessary for any punishment to take place, because over time, if the cheating kind of behavior had continued, no punishment is necessary because nobody would want to play with someone who continues to cheat. And in that way, right, we get this bridge all the way up to higher scales of abstraction, where when a nation starts to play games in a way that, you know, they're not living up to their own standards and not playing by their own rules. And in fact, what that effectively means that they're doing is being a judge in their own case and determining that their needs supersede their previous commitments. Basically, other people stop wanting to play with them. And, you know, it's really, it can be that simple.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's this like outcasting that occurs when one decides to be partial to one's own interests. That can occur. When I think about it also, partiality. So there's impartiality and there's partiality. And partiality is also, I would say, you know, at work in discrimination, white supremacy and so forth. So it's not the case that there's outcasting all the time. But yes, I think if enough eyes are on the behavior, that can have a powerful effect. But I think, enough eyes are needed and consistently and over time.
Yeah,
Anybody else?
Seems to be like the sort of driving mechanism to the nonviolent protests, right? It's like get the nonviolent protests on camera. And everyone can see clearly what's going on, and there will be a revolution of thought that emerges out of that, which is, you know, roughly speaking, the mechanism at work.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And I don't want to go too off tangent, but with when we're talking about, like, extrajudicial killings, or we're talking about, you know, people being violent, police, you know, the national conversation has been about police brutality right now. But it really extends to anything. Like, in that situation, like, the policeman or the person who is perpetuating violence is involved in that situation, and they're going to be biased. And I think that's why we have courts and why we have these, like, separate situations where if you cannot, you know, if you can't be impartial about it, because you probably can't be, like, we're going to have this other institution decide what is, you know, what society says, because the two people involved in a conflict are going to be partial about it. So a lot of the problems that we face in society are because either, like, people want to play the judge, right? Like, the police officers want to play the judge and take that, like, step to be the judge, even though that's not what they're equipped to do, and they cannot, they can't step outside of themselves or restrain themselves.
And of course, the judges themselves could be partial. The federal courts
absolutely
could be partial. And I just go back to our one of our earlier shows where we talked about an appeal to the world, which was a brief submitted by the NAACP to the United Nations in 1947, and they're just pointing out that the very legal system is heavily partial. And what they're trying to do is get international attention drawn to that fact. So there's that piece. But yes, sometimes we can't be impartial. And this gets into, like, this really we're going to end really soon, because I think that there's a connection, a very, very deep connection to this notion of impartiality and the golden rule and listening to, like, the inner law. And, I mean, for lack of a better term, you know, the true self. And I think a discussion of Immanuel Kant is in order here. We don't have time to do it today, but we're talking about impartiality and judging your case, that has to be cultivated in the individual. as you're pointing out. Michael, you want to have the last word here because we're running out of time.
Sure. I absolutely loved Randy's example of, you know, sort of being able to abstract from this very, you know, sort of innocent way of one being partial to their interests and then sort of being able to extrapolate that out to the national level. I thought Taylor's point was also really important. And then that discussion you had with her, Hope, about even the individuals who are tasked with being impartial, they themselves can also be beholden to their own interests. For me, I sort of have this view that partiality is this toxic lens that distorts your worldview. I think partiality is also partially driven by fear. Like Taylor said in this national context, like when you live the quote came to mind, when you live a lifetime of privilege, equality can seem like oppression, and that you to dispel that notion that education and engaging with other individuals who exist outside of what you see through your partial lens is paramount to changing that context to which you interact with in the world, and hopefully one day getting to a point of impartiality instead of being just beholden to your own interests. So, you know, definitely lots to continue to reflect on for sure.
Indeed. It's a lot. And we're all trying to make a clearing and navigate through these concepts, which are very, you know, intimately connected and for both the individual and the nation and the world. So we will leave it there. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace. We will continue this discussion from the Golden Rule to the Freedom Rides, reflecting on peace and justice, hopefully next week. And if you want to sort of get caught up, our August 27th show begins this dialogue. But also, I can't remember the exact date of it, but we do have a show where we talk about Killer Mike and his sort of call for us to organize the world, organize, plan, strategize, mobilize. It's that show that is also relevant to these ideas. So thanks, everyone. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace, and until next time.